when you want to have more energy and more ability to write, it really comes down to one thing, one fundamental thing, and that's electrons. At the end of the day, you're a battery. Your job is to make enough electrons to do what you want to do. We call that energy. And you get your energy from food, you get your energy from air, and you get your energy to some extent from light and magnetism. Like there are important elements there. The problem that most people have is that they have unstable energy supply to their head. Your brain and visual processing system are probably using 20% of your calories. Your heart, your eyes, and your brain have about 10,000 mitochondria, these little power plants in your cells, per cell. So they're very dense in energy consumption. The rest of your body has 1,000 or 2,000 per cell. So you have 5 to 10 times the energy consumption and energy production ability in your brain. That means, especially if you're smart and you're focusing a lot, if you have slight perturbations in your ability to bring energy into those cells, it's basically energy brownout.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Before we start the episode, I just want to let you know that our new book, Unmistakable, Why Only Is Better Than Best, is now available to order. It's on Amazon.com. You can get it at Barnes & Noble or your local bookstore. And if you happen to be a fan of audiobooks, you can actually listen to it on Audible as well. And if you're looking for something that condenses all of the wisdom of the podcast and all of the interviews into a book form that is readable and digestible, I think you'll find that Unmistakable is a really, really great companion to the podcast. And for those of you who've been listening for a long time, this is one of the best ways that you can support the show. Today's episode, as always, is sponsored by our friends at HostGator. So if you yourself have aspirations to do something like write a book, to record an album, to start up a company, or do anything, usually a website is one of the easiest first steps. In fact, it's the first thing you should do because it will lead to all sorts of other things. And fortunately, our friends at HostGator can help you get started because they're providing 30% off all of their hosting packages. All you have to do is visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative for 30% off at checkout. And let's say you're intimidated by design. Well, that's where our other sponsor for today's show, DesignCred, comes in. So let's say you don't know anything about how to design a website or make the layout look good. You can actually use a service like DesignCred, and they can help you with anything, you know, ebooks, flyers, websites, logos. And this is how it works. You go to designcrowd.com, you submit your design brief, and you'll get submissions from anywhere between 60 to 100 designers from around the world. If you like what you can get, you can then approve payment. If you don't like what you can go back to the crowd and ask for more or ask for your money back. And because you're an Unmistakable Creative listener, you're getting $100 off your first design project. So visit designcrowd.com/creative and use a promo code creative for $100 off. Dave, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. So, you know, we had you back in the day when we were called Blogcast FM, when we were primarily a podcast for bloggers. And, you know, your work has evolved as well as our brand having significantly, you know, transitioned from what it once was. Because I know that your work extends far beyond keeping a blog. And we will definitely get into all that. But where I want to start is by asking you, what is the most important thing you learned growing up from either a parent, a teacher, or a coach that ended up having a profound impact on your life and the work that you've ended up doing?
One of the things that my parents did for me is they taught me to read when I was 18 months old. So I've been able to absorb a lot more information than the average person just because I've read more books. Uh-huh. And my reading speed when I was really young was higher than average. I think here now my speed's about normal. But just that love for books, love for reading, and love for knowledge has really helped me quite a bit. And it also had a likely side effect that when you spend a lot more time as a baby reading than moving, it changes your nervous system and probably not in a positive way. So my functional movement skills are lower, but my cognitive skills are higher. Mm. And learning how to overcome and hack that to bring my neurology in line with the level of functional movement I wanted was also actually something I'm grateful for because it gave me a chance to learn how to biohack.
Mm-hmm. So parents listening to this, I mean, they're going to hear one of two things. That sounds torturous. I should never do that to my kid. Or how the hell do I get my kid to read by 18 months? And I'm very curious, you know, you being a parent now, also being exposed to all of the sort of biohacking work that you've done, which we will get into in a lot of depth. How does that impact your perspective as a parent? What would you tell other parents about all of this?
Well, what you do in the womb has more influence than what you do in year one, and what you do in year one has more influence than what you do in year two, because you're basically putting in operating system rules in babies that tell them what the environment around them is like. Uh-huh. So my kids are going to a Waldorf school. They're late readers, and I'm focusing for the first 7 years of life almost exclusively on neurological and emotional development. Mm-hmm. The way I look at it is my kids will be plenty smart. They can read as much as they want, and my daughter does read as much as she wants, but she didn't learn to read as early as I did, not by a long shot, but she did spend a lot more time climbing in trees. Mm-hmm. So I think that might be more important from an evolutionary biology perspective. Sure, I'll tell you in 18 more years.
Well, you know, it's interesting to hear you say that. I don't know if you've seen it. Michael Moore recently did a new documentary called Where to Invade Next, and he goes to Finland to basically look at, you know, their education system. He looks at different social services in every country that he visits. But, you know, Finland has one of the best education systems in the world. And, you know, they said their secret is no homework.
Yeah.
Like children need time to play, to laugh, to grow, and to do all of these things. I think, you know, what's interesting to me about what you said, chances are, I'm sure you probably know about the Landmark Forum. And yeah. One of the things that's interesting about Landmark is when they tell you about the Landmark Forum on the first day, they say, yeah, the Landmark Forum for kids is like half a day. The one for adults is like 3 days because adults are so fucked up that we have way more work to do. And so, you know, having this perspective, why do you think it is that we don't prioritize these kinds of things in the way that we bring kids up, the way that we educate them? And, you know, is it just a matter of the fact that we haven't had the awareness until now to know all of this?
I think we haven't had the awareness. And there's also other stuff that happens. When you're an adult, you live in your head. You're cognitive. You think about stuff. Mm-hmm. And when you're a kid, you feel about stuff. And growing up is in large part this idea of learning to tell yourself stories about your feelings, mm-hmm. that match what you're supposed to feel. Because even as adults, we feel things and then we tell ourselves a story about why we feel them. When we're kids, we just feel and act. And with adults, we learn to not act. So the feeling happened, we didn't act. We thought about it, and then we chose the correct response. So it's that inhibitory response that allows us to not basically eat everything, screw everything, and kill everything, which are the three big behaviors we have, right?
Yeah.
And when you're like 5 years old, pretty much, well, you're not going to screw anything because you don't have the hormones yet.
Right.
But otherwise, you'll eat everything and break everything because that's just what you do. So when I look at this whole picture of it, as adults, we assume kids are like many adults, but they don't have a prefrontal cortex till they're about 24. Uh-huh. It's not fully formed. They have it, but it's not all the way solidified. So I think we do this because we don't understand what's going on from an emotional development perspective in kids very much at all. And every adult does their best. Every adult has all the programming that they received as young children. This is survival programming. Uh-huh. And one of my passion projects is this thing called 40 Years of Zen, which is a very high-end executive neurofeedback program, 5 days. And what we're doing there is sticking a bunch of electrodes on your head with a lie detector so that you can see what programs you have running in your head that you got as a kid. And it's amazing how many people were almost dropped when they were two, and now they're afraid of flying. And it's because the nervous system makes all these weird things, and then you end up reacting in ways that you feel guilty about. But it's all basic survival programming that your body was trying to put in place in those first 7 years of life to make sense of the world before you could think about it. Mm-hmm. And to go through it myself, I spent 10 weeks of my life with electrodes on my head running a lie detector against myself. So I know my programming. In fact, I've been able to rewrite a lot of it. So the voice in my head is gone. Like, I don't have a guilty voice criticizing me like I did when I was in my 20s or 30s. And things like that, most people, that's all invisible. That's just part of their condition. So, of course, it's going to affect how you parent. And I'd like to think that my work on personal hacking has changed how I parent.
Okay, so we're going to get into the rewriting and the reprogramming because I have so many questions about that. But before we get there, walk me through sort of, you know, early high school, like what you were and how it piqued your interest in all this stuff and kind of the journey from there to who you are today. Like what social groups were you a part of in high school, college, and how it led to all the things that you've ended up doing?
Well, I grew up in a basement, which was nice. We had a nice house. It was a fully finished basement, but it had been flooded. And my bedroom had toxic mold growing behind the walls. And no one knew about this in the 80s. So I was always inflamed. I actually was obese as a kid. And I just always had nosebleeds, like sometimes 5 or 10 a day, which is a classical sign of mold exposure, as well as behavioral problems that come from this. So I had like oppositional defiant disorder and obsessive compulsive disorder and ADD. And on top of that, I'm 6'4", and I peaked out at about 300 pounds, and I'm around like 220 right now and relatively muscular. So I looked at what happened back then, and there's something called Napoleon's complex. And this is why Napoleon, who was like 3 feet tall, I have no idea how tall he was, but he was short, he invaded Europe because he had something to prove. Well, when you're in seventh grade, the shortest guys in school all have something to prove, which means they have to go try and beat up the big guy, completely ignoring physics. This would be the lack of prefrontal cortex. And I can remember one conversation with this little kid was wanting to get in a fight with me. I'm like, dude, you need to understand physics because I can put my hand on your face and you can't touch me. Like, this is not going to go well. And of course, it never goes well. So I got in a good number of fights. I never threw a first punch, but I usually threw the last one because I was bigger and fatter. And, you know, you can sit on someone who weighs 60 pounds less than you and they really can't do anything about it. That's not a really healthy way to grow up. So I didn't have a big social circle. I was not considered one of the cool kids by a long shot. And I frankly didn't know most of my classmates' names and I didn't make eye contact with them because I had most of the symptoms of Asperger's syndrome and Asperger's runs in my family. So I was somewhere on that end of the spectrum, and I've changed myself biologically and neurologically to the extent that people who knew me 20 years ago usually don't even recognize me. I mean, they know my name, they might know my voice, but otherwise I'm a very different looking and acting human being, and there's a lot of change that's possible there. I look back to what I was like back then. I played soccer for 13 years until my knees failed. I had arthritis in my knees when I was 14, 3 knee surgeries by the time I was 23. I started getting stretch marks when I was 16. I still have a ton of stretch marks. I'm actually working on a little side project about like how do you prevent that from happening for people. I've managed to lose the weight, but I still have like zebra stripes on my hips and my butt and my abdomen, which probably won't go away even with like lasers and cool stuff like that. So it's not that it matters that much. I have kids. I'm married. Like, it's more just can I overcome that versus I don't feel adequate because I have stretch marks. So it's a weird thing, but I look back on that and I was not a happy kid. I was sympathetic dominant. My fight or flight mode was always triggered. And I was generally stressed and unhappy. I found out when I was 30, one of the major reasons that I was just always stressed, it had nothing to do with anything I had control over, knowledge of. When I was born, I had the umbilical cord wrapped around my neck. And it didn't cut off oxygen flow to my head, so I didn't get brain damage or anything. And I wrote that off as a trivial curiosity. When I was around 30, I got divorced. And I was like, I need to understand like what happened. Like why did I do this? And I was just mystified by it. So I went to a personal growth, like 10-day thing, not knowing anything about what I was doing. Just a friend said, you need to go. And if I tell you what it is, you won't even go because you're too scientific. Like, I'm fine, whatever. Like, I'll just suspend disbelief. And I'm so miserable, I don't really care. So I went and I met this lady who'd spent more than 30 years studying adult and child development and psychology. And she picked up right away that I was a little bit anxious, even though I didn't know it. And I'm like, I'm a little angry, but I'm not a little anxious. And she said, tell me about your birth. And I'm like, my birth? Like, I don't know, hospitals, vaginas, I'm pretty sure I was there. Like and I just said, oh, yeah. And I know that the cord was wrapped around my neck, but it didn't do anything. because they didn't cut off oxygen. And she said, got it. And she put up a PowerPoint slide. And it was like a SWOT analysis, that strength, weakness, opportunity, threat, like full on had me on display, like all of my strengths, all of my weaknesses. She just knew them. And I just looked at her, I'm like, how did you know that? And she said, well, it's science. Like, we've been studying for decades what happens to adult personalities based on what happens around when you're born. And I had a tear come to my eye because I was like, why didn't anyone tell me this? Like, there's no way she could have known that stuff. And so then we sat down as part of that program. It's called the STAR Foundation. And they're still around. And they go through all this unusual transpersonal psychology stuff and basically show you the behavior patterns and sort of the programming you have. And it was really hard work. And I actually tend to prefer the neurofeedback approach these days, but I'm really grateful that she showed me that is one of the things that affected me. I came into the world without any ability to do rational thinking or any like situational awareness, like pure reactivity, the way an animal comes into the world, because that's how you do it as a baby. You have emotions and feelings. And I came in being choked. So, like, I'm coming into the world that's a hostile place. And if that's the way your core nervous system is set up, you actually optimize your system for survival instead of for thriving. And my first book is called The Better Baby Book. And it's what do you do before and during pregnancy to have healthier, smarter kids based on the science of epigenetics. And if the environment programs you, well, one of the first things you can do to program a kid to be calm and happy and focused is bring them into the world gently instead of bringing them in with beeping machines, bright lights, sticking them with needles, and potentially choking them with an umbilical cord. So when I had my kids, I had them at home. I say my wife had them at home. I delivered both kids in warm water. The risk of that is actually as low or lower than hospital birth for a healthy pregnancy. But more importantly, so I don't think I was taking great risks there, but I don't think I was doing any harm, and I was probably doing good. So it's cool that you bring your baby into the world however you can bring it in, because sometimes that's not an option. Economically, or because you needed to have a C-section for an emergency reason. But I'm horrified at some of the birth practices, particularly in the U.S., because the rest of the world, including Finland, that you talked about earlier, they don't do the same thing. Wow. So kind of a long story there, but one of the reasons that I was the way I was as a teenager and all is because I was chronically socially anxious, and my sympathetic fight-or-flight response was always turned on because I came into the world thinking something was trying to kill me.
Mm. Wow. So that raises, a question for me. This is out of personal curiosity. So one thing I know about my own birth is that my dad wasn't there for it because he started a PhD in Australia. And I was born in India, and we met up with my dad, I think, 3 months after I was born. I'm curious, what is the impact of something like that I may not even be aware of?
You know, you probably have issues with the way you interact with men. And you could take that as, what kind of an asshole would say something like that. I see this all the time in guys who go through the neurofeedback program. Mm-hmm. Everyone here on Earth has issues with their parents because it doesn't matter that your dad had a really good reason for that. Yeah. You didn't understand that at the time. So all the raw emotions go in, and the raw emotion was, I want my daddy. I don't have my daddy. Therefore, I might die. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I'm not safe. And therefore, maybe men shouldn't be trusted. And all this stuff happens. It happens faster than you can think about it, because these are raw emotions. They're instincts. They're programs meant to run without the delay that a cognitive rational thought has. So later in life, say you're sitting in a conference room and someone walks in who somehow triggered your pattern recognition system that looks kind of like your dad or reminded you of him for some reason, and it triggers some emotion. Maybe it's distrust, maybe it's fear, maybe it's worry. All of that is below your level of consciousness unless you're a very unusual human being or unless you're very well trained. And once that program runs, then the feeling is received by the rational part of your mind, and then the rational part of your mind says, oh, I bet I can't trust that person, and then makes up a story about why you can't trust them. But the truth, the actual order of events was you felt a feeling of distrust, and then you told yourself a story about it. And like every bad thing I've ever done generally came from that kind of behavior, because those feelings are there to keep you alive in a world where the big threats are tigers and falling off cliffs and starving. And those are not really things I deal with on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So walk me through from high school to college to bulletproof, like how you become known as this bulletproof guy, because I know we talked a little bit about some of that the last time you were here. I remember you told me you're one of the first people to ever sell anything on the internet, which I thought was so fascinating. So walk me through that journey a little bit.
So you want like the end of high school kind of thing?
Yeah, end of high school to, you know, the first company to Bulletproof. And then we'll start really kind of digging deep into the biohacking stuff.
So I had an interesting high school experience. The first 2 years I went to a top-ranked school in the country that was modeled after college, had thousands of students and a different building for each subject. And then the last 2 years of high school, I went to a small farming high school in the farming part of Central California. Where I was, you could say, not challenged academically. I was number two in my class, and I barely did anything. Like it was not the best preparation I could have had for my college experience. I went to UC Santa Barbara, and I studied first electrical engineering after I failed out of physics the first time, which was the Weider class there. I'm like, this sucks. I switched to computer science, which meant I could put off physics for 3 years. I'll tell you, I struggled academically. I didn't do that well socially. I didn't do that well academically. I was very interested in entrepreneurship, and I was really worried about being able to pay for school. And my parents made just enough money. They worked for a government-funded national laboratory. And I was like, all right, I have enough money saved to cover my tuition, but not necessarily books and what I'm going to cover with living costs. My parents gave me some money or loaned me some money for living costs, but it was pretty tight. So I was always working. I worked at Baskin Robbins for a couple years scooping ice cream. I was a pretty good scooper. I got this huge muscle on my right arm from scooping. And at the same time, I wanted to start a company. I was so interested in entrepreneurship. The problem was that the most reliable source of income for me during summers was working in an auto parts warehouse. So literally, I would come home from studying computer science and all this stuff, and I would go into a hot and dirty building, and I would pick up like coil springs and gaskets all day long, numbing work, just looking on a list on a piece of paper, throwing them in boxes, taping up the boxes and shipping them out and doing it again all day, every day, because I made twice as much as I could make working at Dairy Queen or something. That wasn't so much fun, but I did it. And after I would work, I would think about how to start a company. And I ended up starting a t-shirt company to sell t-shirts at UC Santa Barbara. There's a giant Halloween thing. It's like 50,000 people show up. They usually light couches on fire. Riot police come. Which is why Playboy at the time called it the best party on the West Coast kind of thing. So I made t-shirts to commemorate this, and I hired a team of salespeople to go around and sell them door to door. And on the night of the event, we had a stand set up, and we would sell $10,000 worth of shirts in a night. And $10,000 was a lot of money back in 1992 or something. And it's still a lot of money, but it meant more back then because the dollar's weaker now. That was profound what it would do. And it was right after that, like, what am I going to do the rest of the year? So I went onto this, onto the internet, and we didn't have the web browser yet. It hadn't been invented. Mark Andreessen was probably writing code on Mosaic 1.0, the thing that was a precursor to Netscape, the browser that was one of the big browsers. And I went on to something called Usenet, and I posted a description of this shirt I had made that said caffeine, my drug of choice, and had a picture of the caffeine molecule. I interviewed a professor of caffeine science that I found on the internet to figure out what to put on the shirt, and I put trimethylxanthine, the name of caffeine. I had just discovered espresso. It actually got me the only A in calculus in my life. Was an 8 a.m. class where I would have 3 shots of espresso, and I'd sit in class, and I could actually pay attention. Because I was medicating myself for ADD. The interesting effects from making that t-shirt were I posted in one of the Usenet forums, and literally within 2 weeks, I had sold t-shirts in 12 countries. Like, there was huge demand. And a professor from Rutgers University was on another news group. It was called, INET Google-marketing. And until recently, you could find all these posts. This was like some of the original history of the internet. And Google, shame on you, Google. Google used to have the Usenet archives available for free. And one day, they just stopped indexing them, so you can't search it anymore. But this conversation was a matter of record. And I flamed this guy, or trolled him, as I guess you'd call it now. And he's like, no one will ever make money on the internet. And my response was, well, I may just be going to a state university and all, or a, you know, University of California, but I'm certainly not going to an Ivy League Rutgers school like you, but I'm already making money on the internet, so you're wrong. Of course, I was the angry kind of asshole college student. And, well, the next day the Miami Herald called and asked some questions about it. A lady named Rosalind Resnick, who founded a company that sold for $250 million in the first wave of dot-com things. And she interviewed me, and suddenly 80 other media outlets interviewed me. And Srini, this is just like what happens on podcasts. Mm-hmm. you source someone cool for a podcast, and then once they're on one podcast, everyone else calls them and then asks them the same questions on other podcasts. Well, I learned early on that reporters are the same way. They're just like the early versions of what we do right now. And the article got copied. I did all these weird interviews. And here I am. I'm this fat, almost 300-pound, a 22-year-old or something, 23 maybe. I don't know how to handle 15 minutes of fame. I don't really know what I'm doing. What I should have done was hopped in my car and driven 60 miles west to Silicon Valley and gotten funded. but I was also, at the time, this goes back to the way I was born, actually. When you believe everything's a threat, it's really hard to conceive of the idea that people want to help. And Marc Andreessen, and for people listening who are like know more about Mark Zuckerberg, well, Marc Andreessen was Mark Zuckerberg 15 years earlier. So this guy was the same age I was. He was doing the same types of things I was. He wrote the software for the first web browser and then went off to Silicon Valley. Notice I didn't, because I was actually afraid. I didn't know I was afraid, but that was what was holding me back. And not only did he go to Silicon Valley to start a company, he teamed up with a guy who'd already started a billion-dollar company called Sun Microsystems. He teamed up with Jim Clark. So here's this kid, same age as me, and I'm sitting there going, geez, I should be doing this, like, but I don't know if I can, and et cetera, all the negative self-talk. And Marc Andreessen goes into Silicon Valley, and he's like, I'm going to team up with one of the most badass entrepreneurs I can find. I'm going to raise all this money. I'm going to start this company, even though I don't know how to do it. So he was willing to seek out and accept help. I didn't think that anyone would want to help. I didn't know that you could do that. I didn't learn that until several years later in life, where I'm like, oh, actually, entrepreneurs and just human beings get pleasure from helping other people. Like, I had to do some more learning about this. So I sold t-shirts for a while. Rosalind Resnick, who wrote the first article about my little t-shirt business being the first e-commerce on the planet. We didn't call it e-commerce because the word hadn't been invented yet. I got a call from her and she said, help me write. So for a while, I became a reporter. I did a review of Marc Andreessen's web browser, NCSA Mosaic 1.0 versus Netscape 1.0, that was published in PC World or something. And so I was a ghostwriter for a reporter, which taught me a lot about how the reporting business works. I also got an offer from Rosalind, and she said, Dave, quit college, come work for me in New York City. I'll give you free room and board. I don't have a lot of money, but we're doing this startup that's going to allow permission-based email advertising. This is the one that she sold to DoubleClick for $250 million.
Wow.
And offered me a bunch of stock. And I was on the edge about doing it, and she knew I could do some work. She also had noticed that I was ADD. My code wasn't very good. I was reasonably sloppy, and she actually made the right call. At the last minute, I was having second thoughts, and she was having second thoughts, and she said, you know, it's not fair for me to take away your university. Like, you should finish your degree, which was a polite way of saying, I don't think it's a good fit. And she was right. I would have failed at that because I honestly hadn't done my self-awareness, my emotional work. I would have gone there and, like, procrastinated and avoided anything that might have been scary, and I would have done it without knowing I was doing it. And it would have been an unmitigated disaster. So good for her for dodging the bullet. Bad for me for not getting stock that would have made me tons of money. So fast forward a couple of years. I've moved universities because computer science to me felt like digging ditches. I love systems architecture. I ended up running a program at the University of California. I would teach systems architecture. Writing code to me is actually not exciting. And that was all they wanted me to do. I'm at the University of California, Santa Barbara. The computer science program there is well-respected, and they want us to write software for symmetrical multiprocessor machines and all this esoteric stuff, which is actually, engineering-wise, very useful for certain applications. Meanwhile, I'm running a business, the first business on the internet, to pay for my training, and I'm talking to my professors, and I'm like, are we going to learn anything about like networking or like how the internet works? And the answer was no. Like, you're going to learn how to do an analysis on this, you know, multiprocessor mainframe thing. I felt so disconnected that I found a degree in information systems, which is how do you use computer science to solve business problems. I ended up graduating from California State University with a degree in information systems and artificial intelligence, which is called decision support systems at the time. So I learned how to actually facilitate good human decision making algorithmically with machines, and that knowledge served me very well. I eventually did make my way to Silicon Valley. My first real job out of college was at a food brokerage. This is part of how groceries get into grocery stores. And I worked in the IT department there and learned that I absolutely sucked at human politics. And I'm actually really grateful. There was a lady I worked with. Her name was Dorothy. And she was a grandmother. Yeah, she had basically stayed at home for 20 years. And then she decided she wanted to go back to work. And within a couple years of going to work at this food brokerage, she was a vice president. So she just knew organizational dynamics intuitively. Like, she had social skills that I have never seen before, being that I'm mostly an Asperger-y style engineer. She could recognize I was smart and that I was motivated and that I had no clue what I was doing. So she would sit me down and be like, okay, here's how to act. Like, here's how to deal with your boss. Here's what's going to work. And she mentored me and taught me like how to behave in the office to not get completely rejected right away. This was conscious learning on my part. And I'm really grateful that she just took the time and had the wisdom to do that.
Today's episode of the podcast is sponsored by TrueCar. So there's something a lot of people don't know about TrueCar, and that's that you can use it to buy a used car as well as a new car. If you haven't downloaded the app yet, check it out, because with just the push of a few buttons, you can set the make, you can set the model, you can set the features that you're looking for, and you'll actually get pictures of the car. You'll be able to see the price that you'll likely pay as well as the discount that you'll receive. And you'll even be able to see that you can connect with a local certified TrueCar dealer. Maybe you're wondering if a lot of people have used a service like TrueCar. Well, there are over 500,000 pre-owned vehicles on TrueCar. And not only that, over 2 million cars have been sold using the TrueCar network. So yes, a lot of people are using TrueCar, and there are 11,000 nationwide dealers. And finally, TrueCar users save an average of $3,279 off the manufacturer's suggested retail price. So when you're ready to buy a new or used car, visit TrueCar.com or download the TrueCar app to enjoy a better car buying experience. And remember that some features are not available in all states. And if you're enjoying the conversation with today's guest, Dave Asprey, you would probably be happy to know that Dave actually has a podcast as well called the Bulletproof Podcast. And the Bulletproof Podcast teaches you how you can take control and improve your biochemistry, your body, and your mind, and help you execute at levels beyond what you'd expect. And they recently talked to the founder of and CEO of MindBodyGreen, the leading independent media brand dedicated to wellness. So to listen to the Bulletproof Podcast and be inspired, go to podcastone.com or download the mobile app.
After a year and a half at that company, I'm like, I know the internet's the future. I started taking classes at the University of California, Santa Cruz in like early internet technology things. And I went to one of my professors, a guy who was a VP at Netscape, and I said, look at my resume. Tell me what's wrong with it. And he looked at me and said, Dave, you've done so much in the field of IT already that I look at this resume, I don't know what to do with you. Like, delete everything that's not what you want to do. So I took my resume, I put it through the shredder, and what was left was internet. I took that out to Silicon Valley, and I got a job at 3Com in the IT department. I helped what became part of Gartner Group write the first white paper on e-commerce. I helped to tie systems together in 5 countries. But more importantly, I started interacting with what was called the Web Guild. This is every webmaster we have today. Came about from the work this group did in Silicon Valley. It's about 500 people who are figuring out how the first generation of websites were actually going to work. I got to give a big speech there and to interact with these guys. And after a year and a half at 3Com, I took that same resume with more marquee company experience. So 3Com at the time was a big badass competitor to Cisco. Cisco kicked our ass up and down the street. And by the way, when I say up and down the street, it was exactly the same street, Great America Parkway in Silicon Valley, where all the networking business and all of Intel sits, basically. So it was pretty interesting. I got two job offers. One was at the company, one was at PeopleSoft, that's now part of Oracle. The other was at Exodus Communications, the company that held Google's first servers and most of Yahoo and most of Hotmail. I took one look at a data center and said, I want to be here. And I joined as a co-founder of the professional services team. Within 3 years, we had 1,500 employees and the company, 1,500 employees in the group that I co-founded, 5,000 companies in the employee, or in the 5,000 employees in the company. And we did $1.2 billion in revenue. I made $6 million when I was 26 for my stock options at that company, and I lost it when I was 28.
Wow.
I think that was as far as you wanted me to go, right?
Yeah, yeah. So that, I guess, takes us right into Bulletproof. I do have some questions about the money, but we'll come back to that right later. Let's get into the Bulletproof concept. And, you know, where I want to start is by going back to what we were talking about earlier. You know, you talked about this idea that what you do in the womb is more important than the first year, and what you do in the first year is more important than the second year, which, you know, I think my first instinct listening to that is, great, I'm completely fucked. Being 38, but clearly I'm not, since you have, you know, made behavioral changes and done a lot of reprogramming. So let's talk about how the reprogramming happens, what results in behavior change. Because, you know, I mean, even as a byproduct of 700 interviews at this point, I can honestly say the behavior change that I've had from when I graduated to business school to now, like, I couldn't predict this kind of behavioral change. I'm like a completely different person. In terms of what I'm capable of. So, I mean, let's talk about how does the reprogramming happen, especially if we feel we're at such a late stage in our lives?
Well, it feels like you're at a late stage in your life at 38, which one thing I didn't mention during that story there is I became increasingly aware of cognitive dysfunction that I was having, and I started spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to fix my brain and to work on losing weight. And I tried all these different diets and sort of the side of I'm hacking the internet, but I'm also hacking myself at the same time. And what you find is that you have more leverage than you think, even at 38. I started hanging out, and eventually for the last 12 years or so, I've been either chairman or president of a group called the Silicon Valley Health Institute. This is a nonprofit anti-aging research and education group that was started in 1993 by one of the few guys who helped to invent Ethernet, the networking standard that basically changed the world. So all this time, every month, we've been bringing in top-notch scientists and researchers who are talking to the public about very cutting-edge findings in science about aging. The average age of our members has to be somewhere around 68 or 70. So I spend a lot of time working with people who are twice my age, and they're getting profound results. You want to talk about someone who's totally fucked? Look at someone who's 80 and has accumulated all that damage, and now they figure out what they can do. They're still not fucked. One of my board members was just an amazing guy. He was a board member. He was 88 years old and carried most of the weight of running the organization. He hadn't always been that strong. He got stronger because he changed the environment around him. Mm-hmm. A lot of the Bulletproof techniques are profoundly popular with people over 50 or over 60 because they get their energy back. I was just old. I had arthritis when I was 14. I had senile cognitive dementia, except I wasn't senile. In my mid-20s, when my brain wasn't working. So I went through it, and I used anti-aging techniques to hack this stuff. So you're 38. You haven't even experienced andropause, probably, when you stop making testosterone. Like, you have tons of leverage. So I would just outright reject that you're screwed now. Okay. And your leverage drops off non-linearly with time. In other words, you have tons of leverage at the very early days, and you have less and less leverage as you go on. So you can basically, not entirely, but pretty much stop many of the aging things that are happening in your body right now. Mm-hmm. You have a really good chance at 38. I'm 43, by the way, so we're about the same age.
Yeah.
you have a really good chance of being able to live. And I say live, I mean fully live, like with a functioning brain and body, able to walk around and interact with people, not in a retirement home where, you know, you've lost your mental capabilities. You should be able to do that until past 100. My goal, I'm doing everything biologically possible to live to 180 or beyond. And people are like, what? Like, people have no idea. Look at where we were 140 years ago. It's like, I'm talking about living another 140 years. I know technology is changing. I know how much control I have of my biology now that I didn't have 20 years ago. Uh-huh. As we're doing this interview right now, I actually just wrapped my face in red and infrared LEDs that increase mitochondrial function and change the viscosity of water in my tissues. I'm not kidding. I just took that off my face a minute ago. So like, oh,
that's too bad. I was going to say you need to snap as a picture to include in the show notes.
I could turn it back on. All but right. Like this sort of stuff wasn't possible. We know mechanisms. My next book is about some of these mechanisms of action and how you can control the mitochondria in your body. Mm-hmm. So when you say, oh, I'm screwed, I'm 38. I'm like, you just don't even know how unscrewed you are. Right. Like you have so much leverage.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about a couple of different things. One is the reprogramming aspect of this. You know, you talked a lot about the stories that we contain, and you know, I think we're really good at turning fiction into fact by our nature, because there's this, you know, we don't have this stimulus response pause that we're all capable of. So that's one thing. I want to talk about it also through the lens of just overall cognitive function. Like, what are the things that can be done on a daily basis? Really, maybe the best way to ask this question is, how can I change my daily behavior from the way I sleep, the way I eat, and the way I work to become what you would say bulletproof, or, you know, kind of like Bradley Cooper in Limitless?
So you want to change your daily behavior to have, well, let's just say specific goals.
Okay.
One of the reasons I defined biohacking the way I defined it, and I didn't trademark that term. I wanted to create a community movement around biohacking, but I have some of the original biohacking domains and like defined the word and wrote the blog post about, is there a space in biohacking or not? By the way, there is no space or dash in biohacking. I took a community poll 5 years ago about that. The definition is changing the environment around you and inside of you so that you have full control of your biology. Okay. Now, for you, full control of your biology might mean I want to have tons of cognitive abilities, I want to have lots of energy, I want to look a certain way. For another person, it could be like, I want to look like a balloon animal. Like, I want 400 pounds of muscle, right? And like, I actually have great respect. And another one could be, you know, I'm a stay-at-home parent. I just want to have enough energy to be calm, even though my kids are asking me the same question 500 times in a row, and I really want to scream, but I'm just going to have enough energy to not scream right now. Mm-hmm. All of those are admirable goals, and all of those are achievable, but it's different techniques.
Okay, let's do this. I will make it more specific so that we have something much more actionable to work with.
Yeah.
So as I told you, I just had a book come out. I also am beginning work on a second one. So I, one, want to be able to wake up in the morning and write for longer periods of time, like sustained focus for longer than I can sustain it right now.
Okay.
But I'm pretty good. I mean, I get my 1,000 words a day, no problem.
That's it?
I mean, I can hit it harder if I really push it. You know, and when I've messed with supplements or, you know, enhancers like modafinil, definitely can push it longer. So that's one. I want my overall physical level of energy to be higher on a daily basis. And I want to sleep better. So, you know, I've talked about this on the show before. I have dealt with periods of clinical depression, which have caused a lot of problems with sleep. And, you know, I want to work on that as well. So I guess those are really maybe three things. So I guess, you know, how would I change? How can I have better cognitive function so that I can write for longer periods of time, absorb more of what I read, and focus on what I'm working on for longer periods of time? How can I increase my physical energy level? And then how do I optimize my sleep? So I guess three things. So that way you have something much more specific to work with.
That is much easier to work with.
Okay.
So energy and focus come together, and we'll talk about sleep after that.
Okay, perfect.
And I'll also tell some stories about what I do when I write, because with all respect intended, if I only did 1,000 words a day, I would be I'd be sad. So when you want to have more energy and more ability to write, it really comes down to one thing, one fundamental thing, and that's electrons. At the end of the day, you're a battery. Your job is to make enough electrons to do what you want to do. We call that energy. And you get your energy from food. You get your energy from air, and you get energy to some extent from light and magnetism. Like there are important elements there. The problem that most people have is that they have unstable energy supply to their head. Your brain and visual processing system are probably using 20% of your calories. Your heart, your eyes, and your brain have about 10,000 mitochondria, these little power plants in your cells, per cell. So they're very dense in energy consumption. The rest of your body has 1,000 or 2,000 per cell. So you have 5 to 10 times the energy consumption and energy production ability in your brain. That means, especially if you're smart and you're focusing a lot, if you have slight perturbations in your ability to bring energy into those cells, it's basically energy brownout. And when that happens, you don't come up with the word you want. You don't pay as much attention as you want to. You get tired, you get distracted, and your willpower goes down because you have less raw energy. It actually is like that scene in The Matrix where they look at Neo before he's out of the Matrix and they look at him and say, shut up, copper top. And you really are a battery. So you can hack your battery. And one of the simplest things that I know of to do is something that I'm quite well known for. And it's bulletproof coffee. Mm-hmm. But it's not for the reason that you might think. So I'm not trying to sell you coffee right now. I'm actually going to tell you about ketones. There's an oil. The recipe for bulletproof coffee is a special kind of coffee beans that don't inhibit mitochondrial function. There's a kind of oil called brain octane. And this is extracted from coconut oil, but it's not coconut oil. And it raises ketones in the body 3 to 5 times better than coconut oil or fasting. Ketones are fat-burning molecules that you normally only get after several days of fasting or eating a very high-fat, low-carb, Atkins-style diet. So why are ketones so important for you to write? When you take a molecule of fat, which is what you're using to make ketones, you can get 147 electrons from it. When you have a molecule of glucose or sugar, you get 36 electrons from it. And I've done several interviews with the luminary scientists in studying ketones. And ketones are associated with reductions in Alzheimer's disease. By the way, I learned about brain octane working at an anti-aging research group, this nonprofit thing that I run, years ago. And they're also associated, ketones are associated with a reduction in just about every chronic degenerative disease you can think of, which is amazing. So anything that raises your ketones is probably going to make you live longer, but they're also profoundly anti-inflammatory. You can go on a special diet, or you can drink bulletproof coffee. Bulletproof coffee, because it has brain octane oil in it, will raise your ketone levels beyond what food could do. So what I did last night when I was working on my book, I've got a deal with HarperCollins for a book about mitochondria. And this is coming out early next year. My deadline is 3 weeks away and I'm 2/3 done with the book and I'll hit it. And I'm going to Burning Man between now and then. So last night I started writing at 11 and I wrote from 11 p.m. to 3 a.m., which for me is a great writing window. I changed the lighting around me, so it's all red lighting, so I don't mess up my circadian biology very much by doing this, because I'm not sending myself the light signal that says it's the middle of the day. My body knows it's nighttime, I'm just up. And then I had decaf, bulletproof coffee, which raised my ketone levels, so I had sustained focus and energy from ketones. I took a handful of smart drugs, not modafinil. I don't generally use that anymore because it doesn't do much compared to what it used to. I'm a fan of something called aniracetam, which increases memory I.O. And memory I.O. is the ability to get things in and out of your memory. So when you're trying to write and you're focusing, and what was the name of that technique? There was a research paper that I wanted to reference. It's at my fingertips. It's always there. It's effortless. That makes a really big difference in order to just have raw ketones. And it turns out when you're burning ketones, even if you have carbs present, I had rice at the same time. I had the bulletproof coffee because I wanted some carbohydrate. And that ability to burn ketones reduces inflammation in the brain. When you reduce inflammation, your energy production machinery, part of it's called the electron transport system. When there's less inflammation, the electron transport system shrinks. You have to move electrons over a shorter distance. It's more efficient. So it's like tuning a race car engine. I did that to my head. So I took smart drugs. I drank bulletproof coffee. Earlier in the day, I had the very healthy foods. I didn't have foods that inhibit mitochondrial function, which is a major problem. I didn't have a glass of wine on this idea that it's somehow going to make me smarter. Wine is delicious. It's just not an anti-aging substance or a performance-enhancing substance. So when I'm writing, I don't drink. And also, there's a great argument. If you look at what pretty much every great writer throughout history, like the really great writers, pretty much all of them were drinking coffee and probably smoking. Smoking's bad for you. I've never smoked.
Yeah.
But if you really want to write and you want to like look at your 1,000 words and just be like, 1,000 words, that's nothing. I would suggest get a nicotine lozenge. Or there's other nicotine delivery systems. Do not smoke. I don't even recommend e-cigarettes. Like, those are bad for you. And on occasion, as a smart drug, microdose nicotine. I wrote a couple blog posts about it.
Okay.
It is one of Mother Nature's smart drugs. There's basically three smart drugs for Mother Nature. There's caffeine, nicotine, which is a mitochondrial stimulant. They both are. And the other one is psychedelic mushrooms. But you don't want to take those and then write. But you might want to take those once or twice a year.
Yeah.
Those can help you form synaptic connections, and they come with some risks. And I'm not endorsing those unconditionally. Like, sure. People can go nuts from that stuff. But there are times when for driving self awareness, or for dealing with trauma or anxiety, or just for making connections that weren't there before, those can be profoundly effective. And at this point, some people get really mad when you say that. Like, look, most of the technology that we rely on today was made by people taking hallucinogens. Like, the DNA was discovered with hallucinogens. Steve Jobs, LSD, most of the people I know in Silicon Valley, maybe not most, half of them, at least once or twice had profound experiences that might have involved substances that they weren't supposed to be on, mm-hmm. that helped to shape the way they shape the world around them. Like, this is, in my mind, something that can be really effective. I'm only bringing that up because if we're going to talk about Mother Nature smart drugs, there's traditionally used by indigenous people hallucinogens, which are a very occasional use. And then there's daily use, which is nicotine, not smoking. Smoking's bad and will take away your life. And it's addictive in a way that occasional use microdose nicotine is not. And then caffeine. Like, if you do those things, you're like, oh my God, and stack that with aniracetam, you'll do amazing things. The other thing that I do, Srini, that you could consider is I use electrical stimulation on my brain. Mm-hmm. So when I'm going to be writing, I hook electrodes to my head and I either run TDCS or more likely something called cerebral electrical stimulation. And you can program what state your brain will be in. Pretty heavy duty stuff, but wow. That's what I did last night.
This episode, just like every other episode, is sponsored by our friends at HostGator. So if you have aspirations to write a book, like I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, maybe record an album, start a company, build an app, whatever it is that you might want to do, one of the easiest ways is to actually get started with building a website. Let's say that you don't know if anybody actually thinks your idea is any good, or you're trying to start something. One of the fastest ways is to build a website and just start capturing email addresses to see if people are interested in what you're working on. This is actually how we planned our first event. It was kind of the iterative process that led there. And fortunately, our friends at HostGator are fantastic for helping you get started, because they're providing 30% off all of their hosting packages for Unmistakable Creative listeners. All you have to do is use the promo code creative at checkout. So visit hostgator.com/creative and use the promo code creative for 30% off. So I told you about our new book at the beginning of the episode, but rather than take my word for it again, I thought you should hear it from one of our listeners. And fortunately, this is also one of our listeners who did the chapter illustrations for the book, and the former guest, Mars Dorian.
Unmistakable by Srinivas Rao. Boy, what can I say? This book is a fast-paced read about realizing your full potential. I really like how the author mixes surfer analogies with real-life examples of creative mavericks, right? Tons of people who excel at what they do, no matter where they come from, right? Some people were like business people stuck in corporate America and then became artists. People who do creative illustrations or just want to create something entirely new, right? the book is about the digital age, where basically anyone with passion can build a creative career, like entirely from scratch. It is so fun to read. It's quite quick to read, actually. I read it, I think, in 1 or 2 days. I just burned through the book, and I really like the sections that inspire you, that give you practical advice on how to really become a unique individual, right? And how to voice that uniqueness inside your company or your mission statement, right? How you really achieve great things by daring to step into the unknown, and where you're willing to do things that others are willing to do. It is basically a little book that can set your soul on fire if you're open to it. And I can strongly recommend it. It's a recommended read. Like, really. If you want to read a really good self-help book and you just need that extra injection of inspiration, give Unmistakable by Srinivas Rao a big fat chance.
Wow, that's crazy. So a couple of questions. One, I know that you have the Brain Octane oil on your site. And also, I'm curious about the coffee beans. Like, if people are to go into a grocery store to buy it, what do you recommend? For the coconut oil, like, do you not use coconut oil then if you have the Brain Octane oil?
Here's the thing. I want everyone to be able to do this for as cheap as possible. Uh-huh. If you use coconut oil, there's a study that's coming out that tests specifically something called MCT oil, mm-hmm, versus coconut oil versus Brain Octane. And I would love to tell you just mix coconut oil in your coffee. I can tell you that's better than putting milk in your coffee. Milk actually takes away the antioxidants in your coffee. It's biochemically not a good idea to mix milk and coffee, okay, which is why butter. But coconut oil does not raise ketones more than eating nothing. It's commonly believed that it does. That is not what the university research shows. So coconut oil is an upgrade from milk, but it does not give you ketones in your brain the way you get from Brain Octane. We're talking 5 times more ketones. So Brain Octane is different than MCT oil. There's 4 kinds of MCT oil. Some of them work to some extent, some of them don't, and it oftentimes causes what we call disaster pants. Okay. In the early days of discovering what worked and what didn't, I used to use MCT oil, and it was kind of a common knowledge that, you'll feel great, but you'll need to run to the bathroom. And Brain Octane got rid of that because it gets you more ketones with less oil. Mm-hmm. So it's like coconut oil is weak beer. Brain Octane oil is vodka or Everclear. Like, it's highly distilled. It's 5% of the oil that's naturally found in coconut oil. It's just that 5% with no flavor. So we're using it as an exogenous or outside the body source of ketones. Mm-hmm. And the idea of we keep hoping that coconut oil will raise ketones. Unfortunately, the science that's coming out of the University of California, San Diego, doesn't support that theory, and neither does my experience. Okay. Coconut oil is better than milk. It is nothing like Brain Octane.
Okay. And the Brain Octane, I know that you have it on your site. Are there other places where it can be purchased?
Yeah. You can go to Whole Foods in 7 of the regions. They carry Brain Octane. And I always appreciate it if people go to bulletproof.com and sure, pick it up.
And we'll link that all up as well.
Sure. Then there's the coffee beans.
Mm-hmm.
I quit drinking coffee for 5 years along this journey I described earlier. Coffee got me my only A in calculus in college. I really appreciated coffee. But after I had lost my $6 million around when I was 28, I went off of coffee because I would drink it, and 2 hours later I would need more, and I'd need more, and I would feel like jittery and kind of anxious, and sometimes I'd get a headache. And I ended up going to Tibet. And I was off of coffee at the time, and I discovered yak butter tea, which was the genesis for the idea of bulletproof coffee. And when I came back to the U.S., I had a cup of coffee, really high-end coffee, and I felt really good. I'm like, wait a minute, I'm cured. I'm not sensitive to coffee anymore. This is great. And the next day, I had another cup of coffee, and I felt just like I'd felt on coffee before. And I just remember thinking, wait a minute, this isn't me. Those were different cups of coffee. And I dug in really hard on the agricultural research around, like, what's going on? Because I'm a hacker. Like, I'm really a computer hacker. And all that decision support systems training and artificial intelligence. And I really realized there's a lot of variables in coffee. And I set up this goal of creating a decision tree for coffee, where if I look at coffee as a system that starts in the soil, ends up in my cup, I could optimize the system for cost or for flavor, which are the two settings you can get today. And I said, I'm going to optimize this for reducing things that are bad for you and increasing things that are good for you. So it was changes in agricultural and in green coffee processing, and then validating that the changes worked with lab testing for 27 different toxins. That's what generated the coffee beans for Bulletproof Coffee. The difference for me, though, is I drink that one cup in the morning made with butter and brain octane, and I'm good to go. Like, I feel great. I may have a second cup because I like it, and coffee is good for you. I'll have it at lunch, and I might do some decaf because I like it, and it's good for you later in the day. But really, it's one cup of caffeinated coffee. So I drank less coffee, but I didn't experience the crash that universally happens, especially in the U.S. The reason for this is that a long time ago, about 20 years ago, when we first started discovering mold toxins were profoundly affecting human performance, most governments, even China, Japan, Venezuela, and all of the European Union, put limits in place for the most common toxin in coffee. It's called OTA. And this is something that directly inhibits mitochondrial performance. So in other words, you have these little power plants, little motors in your cells. If you get OTA in your food at 5 parts per billion or higher, you can't taste that, by the way, it makes you make less energy. My mitochondria are relatively sensitive because I grew up in a house with toxic mold. So I probably feel it more than most people. However, there is no argument for increasing your level of OTA. What happens, and I have a former president of the Specialty Coffee Association telling the story on video on my YouTube channel. It's like, you couldn't make this stuff up. He's in Japan and Ethiopia. Ethiopian coffee is supposed to be really good, right? Ethiopia sends 1,000 containers full of coffee. That's a lot. To Japan, those big shipping containers. And Japan does the testing and says, oh, these don't meet our standards for mold toxins. So they rejected the shipment. And so I asked this president of the Specialty Coffee Association, what happened? Like, where did it go? And he said, we sent it to America because there are no standards there. So what I'm saying here is that coffee in America, even the really flavorful, amazing coffee that's made by the best baristas on earth, it's designed to taste good. It is not designed to be low in toxins that make you feel cranky and jittery and yell at people and have sugar cravings 3 hours after you drink it. To validate that, in my first book, The Bulletproof Diet, I actually published a crowdsourced research that we did where we had people try coffee purchased at their local coffee shop versus the lab-tested Bulletproof coffee beans, just black coffee or with butter, and to look at the difference on 7 measures of cognitive function. And we found statistically significant improvements in cognitive function on 6 of the 7 when you drank coffee that was without the toxins versus coffee from untested coffee, you know, coffee from normal coffee processing. So what I'm saying is parts per billion levels of neurotoxins actually matter. And by minimizing my exposure to neurotoxins, I'm expecting to live longer. But more importantly, I feel better and I perform better every day while I'm working on living longer. Bulletproof coffee is part of that.
Okay. Are there other options for the coffee that are accessible in our grocery stores yet? Or
if you have a natural foods grocery store there, like there's national distribution for Bulletproof coffee. So a lot of the independent resellers, depending on what region you live in, Central Markets in Texas has it. Whole Foods carries brain octane oil in some markets, not others. I'm working on getting the coffee beans in there. But right now your best bet is to head to Bulletproof and I'll just send you coffee every month. Or every 2 weeks, what will happen is you'll drink a lot less coffee. It costs about $2 a bag more than normal coffee to cover the cost of lab testing. You get the 5-pound bag. It's as cheap as buying any kind of coffee that you would buy at Starbucks or something. Like, okay, it's not terribly expensive when you get 5 pounds. It is, I mean, we do a lot of testing, more testing than any country, anyone on earth. And the process for making the coffee required putting infrastructure in Guatemala and in Colombia in order to do it. So like it's different. You feel different. And when you try it once, you're like, oh, actually, I didn't crash 3 hours later. I didn't have the afternoon food coma. I didn't want to eat the cookies. Stuff like that. It's subtle but repeatable. And there's just tens of thousands of people who have left testimonials over the last 5 years about like I can't even explain how different it is. So it's worth a shot. And okay. you might tolerate normal coffee, you know, just buy whatever's cheap or just, oh, it's organic. But organic coffee is still thrown in a cement-lined tub with unfiltered water, and it sits there for 2 days. Well, it basically lets the fruit on the outside of the bean spoil, and that's where the problem comes. I don't allow that to happen to the beans that I sell people.
Okay, so let's talk briefly about sleep. Then I want to ask you a question about money, and then we'll wrap things up.
All right.
So where do we begin with sleep?
Well, the sleep starts with darkness. For 4 hours after you are exposed to light, especially blue light or white light, you don't make melatonin. That means that if you're staring at your phone before you go to sleep, you are not going to make melatonin for half of the time you're supposed to sleep. Melatonin is your sleep hormone. It's a repair hormone. It's anti-inflammatory. It's anti-cancer. The lady who first really highlighted this was called T.S. Wiley. And she wrote a book called Lights Out I think the early 2000s. It was summarizing hundreds of research studies about how important this was. And she was one of the big people who influenced me to start writing about hacking your sleep. And I believe I'm the guy who popularized orange glasses in the biohacking community, because orange or amber effectively blocks most of the blue spectrum that inhibits your sleep. So for you, this means dimming the lights. It means going into every room that has a white or a blue or a green LED and putting a little tiny piece of electrical tape over it. I'm not kidding. One tiny blue LED in your room sends a signal to your body. It's absorbed through your skin or through your eyes that says it's not nighttime. That shade of blue is not present in a normal world, and it is highly biologically disruptive. I actually believe that we are going to experience huge problems because we've switched to LED lighting. Mm-hmm. Even during the day, the LED lights that we use make 5 times more blue light than normal incandescent or halogen bulbs. My house has no LED lights in it, except red ones, which I use in the middle of the night. When I stay up late writing, I have red LEDs. Looks like a submarine. I can see just fine. But my body knows very well that it's pitch dark because red light doesn't affect your sleep one bit.
Wow.
So black out your room. If you live in a city, in the last 3 years, they've replaced your streetlights with biologically harmful streetlights that make way more harsh white-blue light than they used to, which is correlated with having more cancer for you, unfortunately. So that means your curtains need to be really good curtains. You should have blackout curtains. And when you open your eyes in your bedroom at night, it should be actually dark to the point that you can't see your hand. If you haven't achieved darkness in your room, then do what it takes to do that. Usually that means investing $100 in better curtains or pull-down shades with tracks on the edge. But in urban environments, it's more important than ever that you sleep dark. Lower your room temperature, 68 degrees Fahrenheit, or even a little bit lower can make a big difference in sleep quality. Before you go to sleep, and the optimal time to go to sleep is before 10:45 p.m. for most people, because you have a little circadian cortisol surge that can happen around 11 when you get your second wind. But going to bed at 10:45 or earlier is nice, which means you need to dim your lights and stop looking at your phone at least an hour or two before that, except you're going to look at your phone. So wear the orange glasses, or I wear glasses, but I put a screen protector on my phones and my laptop, and it's something I manufacture. So yes, I have a financial incentive. No, it won't change my life if you do or don't buy this. I manufacture it because it's cool and because I wanted it. It's called the ZenTech screen protector. You put it on your phone. It filters out the most harmful spectrum of blue that most suppresses sleep. It's not a complete solution, but even if you have your phone with Flux or one of those apps that dims the screen at night, this cuts out all of this narrow band spectrum that's most harmful for your sleep. So I have that on my phone. I have the glasses on, and then I can look at my phone. I can do whatever I want to do. But if I'm staring at a big screen TV with an LED backlight, and I have LED lights in my bathroom, I'm not going to sleep well, and neither is anyone listening to this. Mm-hmm. So let's see. We talked about lights.
Yep.
Talked about temperature. Let's talk about relaxing.
Okay. So
do you have a hard time like going to sleep or staying asleep?
I mean, at this point, you know, it's going to sleep. That it's gotten a lot better in the last year, but there was a period of time when I was under an immense amount of stress, and I was having this issue where I would fall asleep and I would find myself awake at like 3 a.m, unable to fall back asleep, often woken up by like heart palpitations.
So you would wake up at 3 with heart palpitations.
And I couldn't get back to sleep, no matter how hard I tried.
All right. So one thing that happens is you run out of energy. I have a cool lecture I'm giving at the Bulletproof Conference in September, September 23rd. I'm giving a talk about exactly this, so it's fresh in my mind because I was just writing parts of it. We talked earlier about getting electrons into the brain for writing. Your brain believes that if there's a shortage of energy for it, that it is a species-level survival event. Because if you don't have enough energy in your brain can't control your system, and then a tiger might eat you. Like it's that level of deep-seated survival. So when your blood sugar crashes, or you just don't have enough of it, which oftentimes happens in a dysregulated system when you're sleeping, because you're not eating when you're sleeping, around between 3 and 5 a.m., this is the common time it happens. Well, as soon as your energy level in the brain goes down, your brain's like, I don't have enough glucose. I'm working on repairing myself here. Get me more energy. Since there isn't food present, it uses two hormones. The first hormone is called cortisol, and the second one's called adrenaline. Both of those hormones will increase blood sugar levels by causing breakdown of muscle or fat. So you get a cortisol spike at 3 to 5 in the morning. Cortisol and adrenaline wake you up. And the reason your heart's palpitating and the reason you can't go back to sleep may be that you ran out of energy and you got a cortisol spike. So there, now your brain has the energy it wanted. Unfortunately, you don't have the sleep you wanted.
Right.
There's two fixes for this that I write about on the Bulletproof blog. It depends on your biology. I don't know how to tell you which one works other than to say try it. The first one is raw honey, not cooked honey. Cooked honey doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Raw honey, about a tablespoon taken before bed, can stabilize your blood sugar for 6+ hours. If you find that having raw honey before bed works, try raw honey with brain octane oil, just mixed together. Mm-hmm. Brain octane oil provides non-sugar energy for the brain. I exist in a state where my brain always has ketones because I use brain octane with every meal every day. And my brain always has some glucose because I eat a low-carb but not a no-carb diet. So I eat vegetables and I eat occasional sources of starch, but not sugar, which means I have the ability to rely on two different energy sources. If you do brain octane and this raw honey trick before bed, you have a source of ketones and you have a stable source of glucose. You will not have fuel problems in your head. And that really matters for how you're going to feel. Mm-hmm. So that would be one experiment. The other group of people do better with a protein called collagen. And yes, I am actually talking about stuff that I sell. And I'm not here to sell stuff. I'm just telling you, I make this stuff because I couldn't buy it. Mm-hmm. And I was a VP at a big company when I started Bulletproof. I just wanted all the stuff. So anyhow, what you'll find with collagen is some people prefer protein and brain octane before bed. Some people prefer that sugar. I think it's a core biological thing. I don't know why it's not the same. Collagen's a neat protein because it's a building block for all of your cells, but it's also called animal starch. We don't get collagen in our food anymore unless you drink bone broth or you eat Jell-O. There is no source of collagen because it comes from boiling bones and cartilage. If you eat unusual forms of Chinese food like pig's ears or chicken feet, you would get it too, or beef tendons. But most of us don't eat that on a regular basis. What I do is I make a collagen protein. It's a powder. It has no flavor. I put it in my Bulletproof coffee much of the time. That way I have the source of collagen, but you can take it as a powder before sleep and water. And it actually can break down into something called butyric acid in the gut. And it's a calming, non-stimulating type of protein that some people really like before bed. So address your fuel source in one of those two ways, raw honey or collagen with brain octane. Mm-hmm. And you'd be shocked at what that does for your sleep. If you're still waking up, I think you want to get a hormone panel and see what your daily cortisol rhythm looks like, see what your thyroid hormones look like. When you're racing hard, I always look at thyroid. And also, you should keep a food journal. No. It's entirely possible that something you're eating at dinner is triggering the racing heartbeat 4 hours later. Mm-hmm. I find that's true if you eat a food you're allergic to, or if you eat a food that's contaminated with problems during storage and processing. Particularly, this is bacteria and fungal growth. You're not going to see it, but if you like, if I drink a cup of really flavorful coffee, 4 hours later, I'm going to have a racing heart and heart palpitations. And that's true even of decaf. It's because of these mitochondrial inhibiting toxins that are in them. So you may have a particular sensitivity there. But that'll hack your sleep pretty dramatically, what we just went through.
Wow. So this has been awesome. There's been so much stuff. So I have two more questions and we'll wrap it up.
Okay.
I have a question about money and wealth. And I mean, you mentioned that you made $6 million at a really young age. You lost it all. I mean, now you're a prominent entrepreneur. I mean, everybody kind of knows you, and I know you've been in, really prominent positions as well. I mean, how has all this changed your narrative around money and wealth, or has it?
Oh, it's profound. So when I was 16, I read Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill, and it's like the quintessential book on, how to set goals and make them come true and manifest reality and all this. So I said, by the time I'm 23, I'm going to have $1 million. And I put this on my mirror and I read this every morning for a few years. And it obviously didn't work. I was 23 and, I had a good job, but I didn't have $1 million. But I figure it worked well enough, right? Age 26 and $6 million. The problem, though, was that I told myself, you know what? I'll be happy when I have 10. Mm-hmm. I literally told myself that. I could have walked away with $6 million. All I had to do was quit my job and sell my stock. But because I was in a prominent position at this company, I was privy to our mergers and acquisition information. I was responsible for deciding whether we should do deals based on the technology side of it, like not the finance side. So in other words, like this technology is valuable, this is not, so therefore we should do a deal. That meant it was illegal for me to sell my stock while I worked there. So I had basically a time when over the course of 9 months, my net worth plummeted from $6 million to like $100,000. That makes you feel like you're going to die. And the biggest lesson that came out of that was, number one, I was no more happy when I had $6 million. In fact, I was less happy because of relationships and stress and health when I had $6 million than I was when I didn't. And the fact that I told myself when I finally hit this profound amount of money, oh, I'll be happy when I have $10 million. No. Happiness is a program setting. That's why I do 40 years of Zen, all this neurofeedback stuff. I run a neuroscience lab in Seattle now, so I can hack my own brain and the brains of other really successful people to get around that kind of programming, because I'm capable now of being happy regardless of financial outcomes. And studies have shown you can buy happiness. It takes $75,000. Which means if your basic needs are met, it actually does correlate with increases in happiness because you're not stressed about survival. After $75,000, money doesn't do anything for happiness whatsoever. You tell yourself a story, it will, but when you have more money, it doesn't make you more happy, doesn't make you less happy. It's all about you. It's all about your narrative, all about your programming. Mm-hmm. That was my big learning there. Was money doesn't make you happy. Losing money sure does make you stressed, though.
All right. One final question, which is how we finish all our interviews at the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
It's an interesting question. Unmistakable? I've never actually wanted to be unmistakable, so it's hard for me to parse that. Let me think about it for a minute. I guess when I think about unmistakable, I think about like branding. Like, I'm pretty good at branding. With all the things I've done at Bulletproof, but I don't. What makes something unmistakable? It has to do with being memorable. And what makes something memorable is usually the story that's told around the thing, right? So you can take two identical scenarios, and one of them is entirely unmemorable, and you won't remember it. And the other one, you tell the story around it so that people can connect with it, and it becomes very memorable. And when something is memorable, it's unmistakable because you know what it is. Mm-hmm. Like, you know how it feels. And when something's unmistakable, it's not that you saw it and you remembered it. It's that you felt it and you remembered the feeling. So I would look at more the emotional side of things about what makes something unmistakable. What's the emotional connection to it? That's what makes something unmistakable.
Awesome. Well, this has been just thought-provoking, eye-opening, riveting. I mean, you just packed it with so much valuable information, and I really appreciate you taking the time to join us and share your story and your insights with our listeners.
Thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure. It was a lot of fun, and I love sharing this stuff, so I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.